This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this week's episode, we listen to an interview with Brian Becker, a founding member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, where he debunks the idea that the United States is an indispensable nation and greater than other nations. He reviews stages of this idea in bourgeois history along with counterexamples of capitalist crisis in the U.S. He also reveals the racist and supremacist meanings behind this idea. This interview is part of a larger PSL educational series we will be releasing in the coming months, so stay tuned for that.
President Obama actually said, "Some may disagree, but I believe that America is exceptional, in part because we have shown a willingness through the sacrifice of blood and treasure to stand up not only for our own narrow self-interest, but for the interests of all." President Obama said that at the G20 meeting when he was explaining why the U.S. had a unique, distinctive, and different role in terms of its ability and desire to intervene in Syria, to carry out military strikes against Syria. 2 weeks before that, his Secretary of State, John Kerry, said, "America is the indispensable nation," again, arguing that the United States had a particular advantage that allowed it to carry out unilateral military strikes in Syria. In both cases, their use of the term American exceptionalism, or the indispensable nation, is premised on the idea that it's different, it's distinct, it's exceptional because it is great. It sacrificed its blood and treasure, as President Obama said, not for narrow self-interest, but for all. In other words, unlike other countries who go to war in pursuit of their own narrow self-interest or the self-interest of the elites that their foreign policy is premised on, the American government, because it's exceptional, because it's different, because it's great, intervenes in order to do good work. Now, President Obama and John Kerry are not the only politicians. In fact, the politicians of both parties dress themselves up under the guise of America's greatness. Mitt Romney, when he was beginning the 2012 presidential campaign, wrote a book called No Apology, The Case for American Greatness. Newt Gingrich, who was also a candidate and a former congressperson, formerly the Speaker of the House representing the Republican Party, he wrote a book in 2011 called A Country Like No Other, Why American Exceptionalism Matters. And in fact, during the entire 2012 presidential campaign, the implication and the core message of Gingrich and Romney and Rick Santorum and the other Republican candidates was that President Obama could not be trusted because, A, he was not really an American and not really an American in the tradition of American politics, in the sense that they asserted that he did not agree with the concept of American exceptionalism. The PSL recognizes that American exceptionalism isn't a new concept, but in fact has gone through different stages or phases or waves of usage in American politics. Most notably, it came back into existence as a powerful political propaganda force during the Ronald Reagan campaign in 1980, and then when Reagan was the president. This was coming out of the Vietnam War, coming out of the defeat that the United States had suffered in Southeast Asia and was suffering in Africa and Latin America and the Middle East and everywhere, and as a result of the rise of national liberation movements and socialist movements. The United States seemed to be an empire in decline as a consequence of its defeat in Vietnam, Reagan mounted a counteroffensive and reasserted that America could be great again, that it could overcome the debacle in Vietnam, that it could take its rightful place as the leader of all nations, and that this was premised on the idea that America was good and great and in fact greater than all other countries. Vladimir Putin, I think, represented probably the concepts, the ideas of most of humanity when, in response to President Obama's recent declarations that America was exceptional, Putin, in that very now famous op-ed in the New York Times, said, "I would rather disagree with the case that he, President Obama, made on American exceptionalism," Putin wrote. He said, "It is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional, whatever the motivation." When Putin said that, it was interesting. The Republicans and the Democrats repudiated him on mass media in the United States. It would seem as if Putin had carried out the most gross attack against the United States and its role in the world by taking exception to exceptionalism. And he was met with this hysterical rebuff. But in fact, most of the world agrees with him that when the United States says it's exceptional, and when I say the United States, I mean the elites and the politicians say the United States is exceptional, they mean that the other countries are lesser. They mean that the United States is rich and powerful because it has some intrinsic, inherent moral and political and perhaps divine greatness that makes it a superior nation. So the world views it as an expression of national chauvinism, as great nation chauvinism by the United States. And they agree with Putin. The term American exceptionalism and all of its meaning is repugnant to them. They reject it because they agree with the different idea that all people are equal, that all nations, large and small, should be treated equally and with mutual self-respect.
Now, Brian, you mentioned that the concept of American exceptionalism, or perhaps more precisely, its significance in the ruling class narrative, has gone through different phases or stages. You said that since the Reagan administration, it has played a more important role in the politics of the ruling class. Can you amplify that a bit on the history of the stage of American exceptionalism?
Yes, I think the history of the usage of American exceptionalism is highly instructive about its true political content as opposed to the mythology or the generalized propaganda around it. As we mentioned earlier, and as you suggested just now, it came back into vogue, especially when Ronald Reagan used it in his second inaugural address in 1984. That was part of the rebound for the U.S. ruling class after the debacle in Vietnam, the attempt to overcome the so-called Vietnam syndrome and the great political polarization and shift to the left within the United States. The United States seemed to be an empire in decline. And Reagan was mounting this right-wing comeback, which now we know is the so-called Reagan Revolution by the ultra-right. But he came back and said, the United States is a city on the hill. It's an exceptional country. And the city on the hill analogy or metaphor was used also in January 1961 by John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address. And it's very interesting to see where this city on the hill, all eyes are upon us, we are different and special and exceptional, where that language comes from. Well, you can go back to the Bible, to the New Testament, and see that it's part of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. But more importantly for our discussion, it was used and coined by John Winthrop, who was the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony starting in 1630. He was a nobleman who had been dispatched to Massachusetts and became the 12-term governor of Massachusetts. And it's he who coined the phrase and the imagery, a city on the hill, the Massachusetts Bay Colony in this new world would be a shining light, a city, and all eyes would be upon us, something exceptional and different. But who is John Winthrop? Winthrop was a nobleman, the lord of the manor in England before he arrived. And once he came to the New World, so-called, and when he was governor, he adopted policies regarding the native people, whereby he said any land, any territory that was not immediately occupied by Indian peoples could be seized by the Puritans, so-called Puritans, by the colonizers, and that the rationale for the seizure of this land would be that the more, quote, advanced people have rights, divine rights, to take this property. Of course, the indigenous population were hunters and gatherers rather than agricultural communities. So parts of each year, the land was not being used or hunted or gathered from. And so during those times and under Winthrop's leadership, the colonizers began seizing the Indians' land. And when the Indians objected, as of course they would, John Winthrop, this great pious Christian, sent armed Christian settlers out to carry out genocide against the Pequot Nation in Massachusetts. And by 1637, more than 1,500 Pequots were killed. The surviving inhabitants were made into slaves of the colonizing Christian pious settlers, or in the case of some of the Pequot males, they were sold to the West Indies as enslaved people. And in exchange for the sale of these victims of Winthrop's terror campaign, the colonizers received tobacco and cotton and African slaves who were then enslaved in New England. So we can see, even by this just short little look at American history, a disguised part of American history, Reagan, Newt Gingrich, Obama, John Kerry, Rick Santorum, Ronald Reagan, John F. Kennedy, all of them using the same imagery of America as the exceptional country, the city on the hill, a divine mandate. And where does it emanate from? From a brutal, genocidal, racist colonizer whose real history was not one of, quote, Christian charity, but of genocide and enslavement of indigenous people. It's highly instructive because it shows that the roots of American exceptionalism are just mythology. It's just propaganda. It's historically false. And the real historical record is a bloody record. And it also sort of inadvertently points to the fact that the U.S. capitalist ruling class indeed became exceptionally rich, not by virtue of some great American know-how or ingenuity, which of course is what they brag about, but because they stole the land of the Indian peoples, they committed genocide against them, and they grew rich off of the unpaid labor of enslaved Indian and African peoples.
Marx, Engels, Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, and other significant figures in the historical communist movement also addressed the issue at different times. Specifically, they addressed the question of why the socialist and communist movement, which was so embraced by the working classes of Europe during the development of industrial capitalism in the 19th century, differed so much in its popularity in the United States. This was certainly a dominant part of the narrative for those in power and academia and the media inside the United States. But can you discuss some of this history and some of the key points of the debate? Was there something exceptionally different about the United States? And did that dim the long-range prospects of communism in the U.S.?
I'm glad you asked that, because while the capitalist ruling class in the United States has declared the United States an exceptional country, something better than all other countries is what they really mean, and trying to use the imagery of American exceptionalism to imbue the masses of people with a national chauvinism and patriotism. The communist movement, the big and main historical figures in the world communist movement, also did address the question of why the United States' political evolution, especially in regard to socialism, was different from the other centers of industrial capitalism in the 19th century, 18th, 19th, and 20th century. As capitalism developed in Europe, so too did the workers' movement. And a mass workers' movement was a socialist movement or a precursor to the communist movement. Marx and Engels in 1848, when they were young men and they're 27, 28 years old, said a specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism. They also made note as they went forward in their political studies that the evolution politically was different in the United States. The socialist movement did not create mass socialist parties of the type that existed in Europe, and they were coping with the idea, dealing with the theoretical and political implications of why this was, and also trying to understand the prospects for communism in the United States. And I think it's very important for our comrades and for leftists in the movement to study some of these discussions. They all, by the way, had a historically optimistic view that while there had been a retarded development of mass socialist movements in the United States, that ultimately the United States would not only have a mass socialist movement, but be, in fact, perhaps the vanguard of the communist movement, as seemingly ironic as that might sound, given the backwardness or anti-communism that's so pervasive in the United States. In the case of one important political debate, one faction of the Communist Party in 1928 and 29, led by Jay Lovestone, argued that because the United States was exceptional, meaning that it had developed a strong sort of bourgeoisification or a bourgeois consciousness that had seeped down into the masses, and because of other factors such as the prospects that even working people or even a poor person could become rich, in other words, that there was class fluidity or class mobility that did not exist in Europe, that the communist movement would not really develop in a powerful way as it had in Europe, in the United States, and the Communist Party should moderate its program to make it less radical, conforming to what he considered to be the inherently less radical position of the U.S. working class. That became a big debate within the Communist Party and between the Lovestone faction and the Communist International, which at that time, the Communist International was the Third International, was under the leadership of the Soviet Communist Party for all intents and purposes, which in turn was under the leadership of Joseph Stalin. The Communist International argued, and this was very interesting, in 1928 and 29, particularly in the early part of 29, that Lovestone was a revisionist, that he was a reformist, because his thesis was fundamentally false, that although it was true that the U.S. ruling class had escaped the phenomena of a mass communist movement, that would change. And it would change because the laws of capitalism would also, in spite of the distinctive differences in the United States, reassert themselves. And when they did, and as they did with greater and greater ferocity, that a class struggle would give rise to a communist movement. Now, Lovestone was expelled from the Communist Party for reformism. He eventually became a CIA agent very far to the right in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. But what was significant was that the debate happened just months before the October 1929 stock market crash. And when the stock market crash happened, the U.S. capitalist economy, which had seemed so prosperous in the 1920s, was cast into a massive depression, the so-called Great Depression. Within a short amount of time, 25% of the working class was unemployed. Poverty was great. Children were literally starving to death in the streets. And sure enough, the class struggle hit a very high stride in the United States. By March 6, 1930, a few months later, hundreds of thousands of unemployed and employed workers were marching together demanding unemployment insurance, which did not exist in the United States at that time. They were led by the Communist Party, which formed unemployed councils. The Communist Party membership grew very exponentially. It had maybe 10 or 12,000 members in 1929. During the course of the next decade, as the class struggle intensified because of the Great Depression and because of the growth of communism, the party grew from 10 or 12,000 to maybe 100,000 members. Workers in auto and steel carried out massive organizing campaigns, and the Flint sit-down strike was emblematic, but there were another 1,000 or more factory seizures in the United States. Workers in Minneapolis and in Toledo, Ohio, and in San Francisco carried out general strikes in 1934. All of those were under the leadership of either the Communist Party or the Socialist Workers' Party or other socialist and communist forces. So almost immediately after the debate and after the expulsion of Lovestone, his ideas of American exceptionalism quickly gave way to the realities of class struggle. But the debate was the issue of the prospects for communism went way further both before and after the Lovestone debate. Lenin and Trotsky both analyzed other elements of the United States to try to understand and explain why the growth of socialism was at a slower pace. In the case of Lenin, for instance, he made the point that at least for white male workers in the United States or white men without property, they had gained the franchise as of 1828, far before the formation of the mass unions and industrial organizations, where in the case of Europe, the workers' parties had been forming and building trade unions before the masses of European workers got the right to vote. And so the struggle for the franchise, the struggle for the vote, coincided with the explosive growth of unionism in Europe. So when the workers finally won the right to vote, they voted for their parties, which were based on their unions. In other words, social democratic parties. Lenin pointed out that the white workers who had the franchise in the United States, thus formed loyalties to one or the other of the bourgeois political parties, either the Democratic Party or the Whig and then later Republican parties, before the formation of mass industrial unions and possibly workers' parties. In the case of Trotsky, Trotsky put particular emphasis on the impact of white supremacy, at least for the white working class, and what a devastating impact that had on class consciousness when so many white workers in different parts of the region, in different parts of the country, had a greater sort of national or racial identity with their own bosses and their own ruling class, as opposed to their fellow African American or black workers, and in opposition, in violent opposition frequently to the black working class. Engels also devoted quite a bit of time to understanding what was different about the United States. He actually said, and this is a quote, "American workers are born conservatives just because America is so purely a bourgeois organization." He said, "It is quite natural that in such a young country, which has never known feudalism and has grown up on a bourgeois basis from the first, that bourgeois prejudices should also be strongly rooted in the working class." And of course, Engels is referring to, and must have been referring to, predominantly the white working class at that time, which was not in solidarity with the African American population and in opposition to big parts of the black community. But Engels is making the point that because the United States was formed not as an evolution out of feudal class society with all of its rigid class structures, where if one was born a serf, they died a serf. If one was born a worker, they died a worker. Where in the United States, the vast land opportunities for a large number of small property-owning farmers from the get-go and the vast quantities of land available to them and the absence of rigid class structures would allow for sort of a bourgeois individualism to strongly take root in the population that was fostered by the ruling class because it comported with the needs of the ruling class to have a national or nationalistic as opposed to class consciousness. When Marx and Engels and Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin all discussed the question of the rise or slow growth of socialism in the United States, they tried to analyze the different aspects of what made the United States different, say, from capitalist Europe, but none of them believed in the idea that the American experience was such that the class struggle or the laws of class struggle would not apply to the United States. They were imbued with complete confidence that the class struggle would come to the United States. Lenin, at the time of the Russian Revolution, right after its victory in October or November 1917, depending on what calendar you're using, wrote his famous letter to the American workers, where he highlights really the possibility for solidarity between the U.S. working class and the newborn Soviet Republic, and also demonstrates his immense confidence in the prospects for socialism in the West, including in the United States.
In summary, can you say how the PSL views the validity of American exceptionalism?
Well, in short, American exceptionalism is a fraud. Of course, we recognize there are national differences, there are national particularities and distinctions, not only between the United States and the rest of the world, but between every country. And for revolutionaries who are building a revolutionary organization and promoting the class struggle against the oppressors, all of the national distinctions have to be taken into account. They have to be taken into account when you develop strategies, develop tactics, come up with slogans. Distinctiveness is key to that. But what's wrong about American exceptionalism is the idea that, one, the United States is greater than other countries, that the United States became the dominant superpower because of the inherent features of capitalism in the United States, which is at its foundation, the main theme of American exceptionalism. And also the idea that because U.S. capitalism is so strong and powerful that socialist revolution is unlikely or even impossible in the United States. In all of these areas, we just consider it to be mythology, wishful thinking on the part of the capitalist ruling class. There is an exceptional character of the U.S. capitalist class. It is the richest and most powerful capitalist class. It has the biggest military. It's exceptional in that sense. It's larger than all of the other militaries in the world combined. The United States is exceptional because it dominates the rest of the world militarily and economically. It's exceptional because while it has such a fabulously rich ruling class, it has an immense poverty, 46 million who live under official poverty, and the real number being 1 out of 2. The income inequality is exceptional for U.S. capitalism. The number of people who don't have health insurance in the United States or can't afford it, 50 million still, that's really exceptional. There's no other major capitalist country that has that. In the case of the prison population, it's very exceptional. The U.S. has more prisoners than any other country in the world. It has 2.3 million in prison, and when you include the people on probation and parole, it's about 7 million. That's exceptional. In other words, these are exceptional characteristics, but they're not good characteristics. And what also made U.S. capitalism develop so powerfully different, in fact, even from the colonizing powers of Britain and France and Portugal and Spain and Italy or Germany, which was a latecomer, or Japan. Unlike these countries that did emerge out of feudal past or semi-feudal past, the United States was formed on a commercial basis, but the commercial basis of modern-day capitalism in America was based on the enslavement of African peoples, whose unpaid labor was really what made the capitalist economy and the capitalist class so big and so strong. It's not just the capitalist class in the South. Entire towns, cities, networks of cities and towns in the northern cities also survived because of slavery or because of the slave trade. That's unusual, that's distinctive, that's exceptional. And also because of the vast landmass of North America, unlike the other ruling classes that evolved capitalism in other parts of the world, the United States carried out genocide. The United States capitalist class carried out genocide against huge, vast parts of an indigenous population, the native Indian peoples, and stole their land and took this fertile land for themselves. It was just outright theft and piracy. And half of northern Mexico, that which we now know to be California or Arizona or Texas, all of it stolen from another country, Mexico in this case. So the idea that America is exceptional because of some sort of divine mandate or greatness gives lie to the reality that it's exceptional based on these other horrific characteristic features. That doesn't mean everything about the United States is bad, of course. We, as revolutionaries in the United States, are confident that we can build a multinational workers' movement based on the needs of the working class, the needs of the poor, the needs of all the people, in fact, that we can expropriate the vast wealth that's been accumulated by the most sordid means by the capitalist ruling class and use it for the benefit of the people so that every person has a right to a job and a right to affordable housing and a right to free health care and a right to free education. And while doing that, because the resources are in fact so great that these same resources could be used for reparations for the African populations that were kidnapped and enslaved and who have never been compensated, they can be used as compensation for the native Indian peoples whose lands were stolen. They can be used as reparations for Mexico and others who have had their territories plundered, like the people of Puerto Rico, for instance. That kind of wealth exists, and we are determined to use it for that purpose. And as the U.S. ruling class's wealth is expropriated and used for reparations for those who have been the most victimized, there is so much there, based on the accumulated vast fortunes of the bourgeoisie, that every worker, every person in the United States can have a decent job and a decent life and feel completely secure and know that their children's futures are also secure.